you started off with this great description of the two grave sites of James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. Could you just do that for us briefly now? What do those two sites look like?
Well, now the two grave sites are better than they were at the very beginning. Now you go to James Madison's grave. It's still on the grounds of Montpelier, which was the family homestead, which has changed a lot over the years. I've been there many times now, and it's always very quiet and removed and a little stark when you go there. It's a tall obelisk. It was only erected several decades after his death. I mean, he was kind of ignored by the memorialists after his death. The property had passed into private hands, and you would have to tramp through somebody's backyard basically to get to the fourth president's graveyard. That's in contrast to Monticello, where you go today and it feels like you're at an American temple. It's just this extraordinary experience. You go up this hill, up this mountain, and manicured gardens, and there's usually thousands of people around. And that was really sparked the interest in the whole project to me. It was trying to mine that difference, how we hold Jefferson up as such a standard and a banner, and then why Madison somehow hasn't broken through to our veneration in the same way. I want to try and crack that problem with the book.
What do you conclude?
Well, I guess I would say two things. I think that Madison himself did not conduct himself in his public life or with an eye to history in the same way that a lot of the other founding fathers did. He was almost actively not only disinterested in but kind of undermining his fame. To me, that doesn't mean that we can't get him to be famous in the same way, but it means we have to work pretty hard at getting around the sort of barricades that he set up. And the reason that I wrote the book in the way that I did and I focused on young James Madison was I think we need to have a relationship with him. We need to see him as a protagonist. We need to see the world through his eyes. I think he's more accessible when you look at his younger and more vulnerable coming-of-age story. You see this young man striking out in the world, figuring out his own path, overcoming his own obstacles, you know, and really realizing his mission in life. And that, to me, is a more accessible person. And that tactic, I guess, has been used in a number of other biographical studies. So there was a book called Young Stalin a few years ago, which, you know, taking Stalin and looking at how he came of age to understand him better. There was even Shakespeare in Love. You see these, you know, various attempts where you go to somebody you thought you knew and you see something different. I guess the second thing about why we don't look at Madison the same way today is I think what he was telling us to do in our democracy was more steady and statesmanlike, and it was almost resolutely unsexy. I mean, and to me, that is why it's so crucially important that we go back to him and kind of dive into what he was telling us. I almost see a healthy constitutional democracy has a head and a heart. It has a spine and a muscle. It has two different sides. It has a ghost and a machine. And the part that the people like Jefferson were telling us was breathing, you know, spirit and ambition into our ideals, which is hugely important. But what Madison was teaching us about was how much we depended on statesmanship and wisdom and challenging public opinion, challenging the lowest common denominator. And that's what this book is about, is how he did that, not just as a matter of political philosophy, but with his own life.
Yeah. And in his early years, from what we learn in American history, one would expect that he was surrounded by statesmen, that everyone had noble intentions and everyone was strong and brave and brilliant. In fact, there were a lot of bozos running around at that time as well.
Absolutely. And that was what provided more of a kind of spur to action for him to become a statesman. One of the anecdotes at the beginning of the book, at the end of the book, is set up in three acts, sort of like a movie. The first act is his youth and him, everything leading up to him arriving in Congress as a 29-year-old. The second act is him starting to become both a revolutionary and a key architect of the Constitution while in Congress. And the third act is the peak where he had to battle to get the Constitution ratified against Patrick Henry, who had become his nemesis, even though he had started off as his acolyte, at the ratifying convention for the Constitution in Richmond in 1788. So when Madison first got to Congress, the Congress at that time in the early 1780s was kind of famous for being packed with low-quality public leaders, let's put it politely. George Washington was writing letters back to Virginia and saying, I basically can't – he didn't use the word clowns, but he might as well have. He just said they're just – you know, using their spending accounts and they're going out to dinner and they're wasting their money and they're not talking about anything serious. They're not solving the country's problems. Madison got to Congress and he wrote Jefferson. The first letter that he wrote back after one to his father was one saying the key problem – and he'd been in Philadelphia for a couple of days – a key problem affecting a country is a defect of adequate statesmen. That was so controversial that it was excised from his – public from his papers until the 20th century when the editors put it back in. But it's so interesting that he would talk about his peers that way. And we use statesmanship right now to sort of talk about, you know, very dignified foreign policy leaders. You know, the James Bakers and Colin Powells of the world is how I tend to think it's used colloquially. And I think that shows that he was using it very differently. It was somebody plunging into really dysfunctional domestic affairs in a very political way. That's what he thought he needed to be. And the key thing that he was thinking about at that point was this inflation crisis, which was crippling the country. You had four different kinds of currency and they were all skyrocketing in value and it was creating a very panicky sense and nobody in Philadelphia was doing anything about it. The custom then when you got elected to Congress was to kind of hit the road in November and get to Philadelphia before the snows hit. Because the roads were obviously just dirt roads. And what he decided to do instead was stay home the entire winter and try and solve the inflation problem by himself, which I think is such a moving, remarkable story. This little guy, and he's 5'4", he's 100 pounds, he's deeply shy, and he had anxiety attacks, which I prove pretty conclusively in the book. So he decides to stay home the whole winter studying books on economic theory to try and figure out what was going on in the country. And then he wrote this 30-page essay at the end of this time where he didn't even publish it for over 10 years. It was kind of a private memorandum, and he kept on doing this sort of thing. He would come up with a private blueprint for his own attacking of a problem. And he concluded that the inflation crisis was not because of the money supply or the particular kinds of currency, the way that people related to these different kinds of currency, the different states or the federal dollars. It was the people's lack of confidence in the central government that would redeem currency itself. And he wrote at great length about a lot of metaphors about if you lacked confidence in the body that was going to redeem basically your debt. He saw a dollar as a promise that it was worth something. If you didn't have confidence in the government, then the money would skyrocket in its purported value. And when he came up with that insight, that was the first kind of light bulb that said, we really have to solve long-term this problem of the central government itself. And that was what fueled his rise as one of the key architects of that point of view through Congress as a very young member.
He was the brains behind the operation in some respects.
Right.
And the solution to the currency ultimately was to allow the federal government to tax. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So at this point, you had the 13 state governments. They had no required relationship to the federal government. The key battle that he started leading was for what was called an impost, which was basically a federal requirement that state governments pay a fixed percentage of their budgets into the federal government. That wasn't individual taxation. That was requirements that states pay into the federal government. And that was part of what he came up with. And one of the first true public acts that he did that made him famous was this speech in the floor of the Congress in favor of the impost. And he did what I refer to as Madison's method. I repeat it through the book as a refrain. Somebody referred to it recently as a Greek chorus. It kind of comes up here and there through his whole young life as this way that he would approach problems systematically with an eye toward getting his own conviction and conscience in order, knowing his facts, understanding the other side, dominating the other side, figuring out a series of arguments that took arguments seriously and really it was kind of a form of intellectual combat, but for the common good. And he did that with the impost. He did a speech systematically laying out the case for why the current system of just asking permission from the states to occasionally give money to the federal government was going to lead to ruin. And it made him very, very famous at a very young age.
I'm assuming that you have that framework memorized.
I
read it to me.
I do.
Because it's really an interesting sort of thought process.
It has 9 key elements. First, find passion in your conscience. Second, focus on the idea, not the man. And by that, I mean we're accustomed to try to win arguments or lay out our cases, and a lot of times in politics, but through ad hominem attacks. He always avoided ad hominem attacks. He would focus on attacking somebody's ideas, and he thought that was more powerful because you kind of shaped the foundation underneath the debate. You didn't just get sidetracked onto these back and forths. Third, develop multiple and independent lines of attack. And to me, that's such an interesting thing because we're so stuck today. You know, I'm an attorney by trade, and you really look for the fancy word is parsimony. You look for one argument that will kind of cut through everything. He was not interested in finding one argument. He would throw everything at a problem. He would look at history. He would look at logic. He would look at ethics. He would look at anything that worked to make his case that he could master, he would put in there. Fourth, embrace impatience. You know, I mean, Barack Obama talks about the audacity of impatience, and James Madison to me was one of the earliest practitioners of this. There were always pragmatists around who were saying, we can wait, we can do this steady, and he would really try and hasten. He was a very impatient young man, especially with policy crises. Fifth, establish a competitive advantage through preparation. He was a master of the private battle plan for going into a debate. Sixth, conquer bad ideas by dividing them. The book goes through a lot of his trials and tribulations and obstacles on the way to becoming this young statesman. One of them was he was a terrible lawyer. He battled with becoming a lawyer through his whole life, and he never was able to do it. He found it boring and self-defeating. But what he was good at was logic. Anybody who's read The Federalist 10 or Federalist 51, he says, you know, there are two kinds of faction, and then he'll press you down that path, and then the path will branch into two more options. And he, by always dividing things into two or three types, he was able to control the debate. And it was a very astute – it's something that lawyers do, and it really helped him. Seventh, conquer your opponent as you conquer yourself. There's a tremendous amount in the book about self-mastery, self-governance. He had these panic attacks which came from – we can't really know what was going on in his earlier life that would generate these panic attacks, but they were incredibly overpowering and they afflicted him through his whole life. But the fact that he rose above them and was able to be this pretty dominant, you know, unlikely charismatic figure, I think goes to the power of self-mastery. And he taught the country to govern its own passions as he did. Eighth, push the state to the highest version of itself. We see a tremendous amount of cynicism and attack that goes back to the beginning of the country. A lot of the debate is about the fight between the Federalists, who he led, and the Anti-Federalists about the government itself. Government itself has always been the key sticky wicket when you're fighting about. And in the beginning, it was Patrick Henry attacking the federal government. And I think that Madison was really interested not in the government per se, but how do you make government better, more noble, more refined, more elevated. The ninth thing was governing the passions. This is the idea of governing the passions goes back to the beginning of politics, the beginning of democracy. And he was really interested in figuring out how do you transcend the lowest common denominator? How do you transcend and govern the passions? One of the key metaphors through the whole book is the passions are a roaring torrent, and how do you channel the torrent as opposed to stop it? So there, we have these parts of ourselves. A lot of his political philosophy that became the you know, his method of debate was and the country he built was how do you don't try to stop somebody from feeling very passionate or intense about things, but you try and channel those intense feelings into a political process where they can ultimately be processed. It's more like a canal with locks than a dam. And that is why we have the Senate. That's why we have statesmen. I mean, that's really the ideal he was setting up. It's important to have these people in our life who are trying to calm us and steady us and impart wisdom and listen, but not just react.
And presumably Patrick Henry was on the other side of that coin. He
Yes.
was a great orator, stirred people up. But in what ways was he Madison's opposite?
Oh, it's just an amazing – it is out of Hollywood. It's out of the epic – battle of types. So my first book was about demagogues. So it was called Demagogue, The Fight to Save Democracy from Its Worst Enemies. And this book is a sequel to that book. The demagogue and the statesman is like the battle royale that goes throughout history. And you have at this point Madison and Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry was Madison's opposite in every respect. He was tall. He was robust. He had a silver tongue. He was a master lawyer in front of juries. He was a revolutionary hero. He was give me liberty or give me death. If this be treason, make the most of it. He was the people's hero. He referred to himself as the people's hero. And at the revolutionary phase, these two, the young statesman, Henry was substantially older than Madison, and the demagogue were fused. So Madison sought out Patrick Henry. He worshipped him because he was a revolutionary, and he sort of worked his way through to a position as one of six governor's counselors. And at this point, the governor's counselor was a hugely important institution. The governor couldn't make decisions without the assent and advice of his counsel because they were so worried about executive power in revolutionary America. But the two started to part ways and then became very vicious enemies as the country needed to kind of mature from, you know, you'd kind of liken it to an adolescent phase as a revolutionary, angry at the father country breaking away, you know, setting yourself up. But we needed to mature and grow into our own country. And that's the constitutional phase, our adulthood. And when that happened, Madison really revolted against Henry and ultimately conquered him at great expense. It was very difficult. Henry turned against the idea of the Constitution. He turned against the idea of a strong federal government. He turned against the idea of Virginia joining the Compact of Unions in this very strong way. He basically used every language, every idea that we would have seen in a George Wallace, a states' rights foe of the federal government. A lot of Tea Party language today that is about Washington or about government itself is very familiar if you look at Patrick Henry's language. And he was, you know, bringing it into contact with this incredibly intense rapport with the people, where he really saw himself as their mirror and savior, the common people, and attacked elites. At one point in the debate, he referred very damningly to Madison's the microscopic eyes of modern statesmen. These kind of – you just can see that, this like green eye shade, you know, using like with glasses and intellectual, pointy-headed, elitist, you know, finding problems everywhere, trying to set up new things, new schemes. And that language and that is, you know, very modern. I mean, these things don't change. And so the amazing thing was that little James Madison revolted against his former boss and created this movement and an argument and a campaign that prevailed, and Patrick Henry lost.
But in the middle there, Patrick Henry did make James Madison's life somewhat difficult. Can you talk about the redistricting maneuver?
Well, this was after the Constitutional Convention happens in 1787 in Philadelphia. James Madison and the other Federalists, George Mason, a whole number of others, passed the Constitution and out of Philadelphia. It needed to be ratified in the states. Madison and Alexander Hamilton, who's become so, you know, newly famous now in part because of this amazing Broadway musical, which I've listened to now like 25 times. I'm just waiting for Madison the musical to come up next. If anybody has any ideas, my website is michaelsigner.com. So the Federalist Papers is launched during the winter and spring after the Constitutional Convention to convince – it's basically a media campaign to try and get the reading public to side with the Constitution. Madison goes to the ratifying convention in Richmond the next summer of 1788, facing down Patrick Henry. He defeats him over the course of that summer by a pretty close vote, and then Henry retaliates in several different ways. I argue through the book that Madison really wanted to be in the U.S. Senate. The Senate, the way that he wrote about it, the way that he talked about it, there were two Senate seats that were available, and Henry machinated to deny Madison one of them. A lot of scholars have said they don't think that Madison wanted to be in the Senate because he sort of wrote letters downplaying his failure to get one of those two seats. But I think that he did badly, and that's where he could have served the nation most according to his genius. And so Henry denied him that. Then Madison decided to run for the Congress, for the U.S. House of Representatives. And Henry, who was back in the governorship at this time, had the districts redrawn so that Madison was going to have to campaign against James Monroe, who was a really close friend of his. And Monroe and he had parted ways over the Constitution and the ratifying convention, which was also this remarkable story that Monroe had decided that the Constitution was dangerous, and he basically tried to copy Madison in the method that I was talking about, employing history and logic and philosophy, and he didn't win. The two remained friends, but this was really tough for both of them. And Madison also hated political campaigning in a conventional way. He had almost never made political speeches. There's this one story where his ear gets frostbitten during one of the – he's outside for so long against Monroe. And the way in which he won – is also an amazing story for any political junkie. He kind of cobbled together votes. His base, to use that term, in Orange County turned out for him like over 90%. And he made significant inroads, actually surprisingly, into Monroe's base. And then some of the swing districts really turned out for him based on some of his crusades of conscience over the years. He had done this fight against Patrick Henry about religious freedom, where there was a proposed tax to support Christian churches. And he had stood by the Baptists who then were a very small sect. They had been imprisoned and abused. And that was in Culpeper, the northern part of the district. You know, he defeated Monroe by campaigning hard and by people respecting his legacy.
And actually, just to go back to the subject of elections, he was not successful. Madison was not successful in his first attempt getting into elected office.
Right. He was in the House of Delegates right after 1776, the Declaration of Independence. There was a new body that was created in Virginia, and he needed to go back and get effectively reelected to his position. And he did this. He was in his 20s, and he did this. He decided that he was going to not just challenge but defy public opinion. And I think that's very important because his relationship to public opinion, leading public opinion, challenging it, educating the public, but always respecting the public. And what he did in this case was not that. There was a longstanding tradition in Virginia that when you traveled to go vote, usually at a courthouse or at another public building, the candidates provided liquor. They made it a party during that day of voting. You know, and think about it, this is time when you had to maybe be on the road for a few hours to get to the place where you're going to vote. And he decided that that conduct was beneath him and beneath Virginia. And he decided to lean into it. And he was running against, among others, a tavern keeper, somebody whose job was to do this. And he lost. And he looked superior and he looked like an elitist. He looked like he not was just challenging public opinion but was above it. And it's amazing to me, a lot of the fun research of the book was going back and forth between many different drafts of his autobiographies that he started writing when he was in his 50s and 60s. And there was one scrap of an autobiography that I kind of stumbled onto where he was going over and over this decision he had made 50 years earlier, his only electoral loss, to defy the public. And he was still lambasting himself. He was still kind of mulling over and criticizing in his mind how he could have made such a dumb mistake, basically. And I just think that he was really a gifted political operative on top of everything else. But that also meant that he didn't let himself off lightly.
One of the areas where he did not succeed in sort of thinking the nation through a successful approach to a serious problem was slavery. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about his experience in that vein?
Slavery is very important through this book. I think that any scholar looking at any of the founding fathers, because of where the country has gone with all issues of race, has to work on this problem. So Madison on slavery is a very confusing and frustrating and complicated reality, a landscape is how I put it. And I think that it's worth studying closely because there are some seeds of the whole other reason that he's complicated and frustrating, brilliant in some ways, self-defeating in others. So on slavery, he was all over the map. Let's begin with one of the anecdotes that I include at the front of the book, which is his grandfather, who was kind of the titan and the patriarch of the family, was, history tells us, murdered by a man and a woman that he owned. I study this a lot because I think that it had reverberations through the family environment that Madison came up with. One of the remarkable things was that the judges who made the decision about the punishment decided to give the death penalty to the slave from the neighboring plantation but allowed the two slaves that Ambrose, his grandfather, they were allowed to live and they were lashed, which was a horrible punishment, but they were allowed to live. I think that that was because the grandfather was notoriously brutal and out of control. And a lot of the evidence that you can find describes him that way. So this idea of the governing of the passions, there were people who were distinctly brutal toward the men and women they owned. And I think that this was one of them. And so I take that as part of what Madison inherits about the relationships with these people who were legally owned in Virginia. And a slave that he owned who went with him to the White House, Paul Jennings, who later wrote a book, and then there was a good book about Paul Jennings, said that Madison, one of the things that he would say is, I never allow the word was Negro, to exceed me in politeness. So you had this way that he seemed to behave with the men and women that he owned, which was very buttoned up. That does not excuse anything that he did or was with regard to slaves. And then I'm going to put on the other side of the ledger the fact that he resolutely refused to free his slaves in either during the end of his life or in his will. And the reasons he gave for that are incredibly frustrating to any historian who's studying them. There was a former aide of his in the White House named Edward Coles, who later moved all of his slaves to Illinois so that he could free them and became governor of Illinois, leading abolitionist. And he launched a 10-year-long campaign to get James Madison, the former president, and Dolley to free their slaves. And the letters that Madison writes back to him are so maddening that it makes me mad today because they're illogical and frustrating. He says they can't afford it. He says that the slaves wouldn't be able to handle the freedom that they would be given in Virginia. He says they're better off. But the fact that he cites the family's finances as a reason for not freeing slaves after he's dead is just maddening. But then on the other hand, so there's always an on the other hand with Madison on this topic, he became president of the American Liberation Society in his 70s, which is setting up Liberia, another country for African Americans in the United States to go to. Now, that was a highly flawed solution, but at least it was an attempt to do something. It suffered from the worst aspects of his thinking, which was a scheme, an overly abstract, you know, highly conceptual scheme that would sort of solve all of our problems all at once. But then on the other hand, there was – I'll give you another on the other hand. When he was young, when he was in Congress for the first time, he made a decision to free a slave of his who was with him in Philadelphia named Billy. And he defied his father. There are these – and the way that he described this Billy was he wrote back his father and he said he just cannot tolerate being a slave. It's not in him. And he had this relationship with Billy where he somehow decided, based on something about the way that Billy was, that he could not remain in that. And then Billy ended up being freed, manumitted in Philadelphia. And then he later went on to become a merchant who had dealings with the Madison family. And he defied his father in that. So it's a mess. It's a hot mess, as we would say. And I think that I don't give him a pass on any of these decisions. I'm very hard on him in the book for what he did about not freeing his slaves because a lot of his fellows did, including George Washington. But it's a mess.
So what would you say is the impact of this book you've written? It's so thorough and breaks so much new ground. Did you get a lot of reaction to it?
I feel like I have. It's been, you know, I'm sort of in this ground where I'm, you know, I teach at the University of Virginia. I'm a lecturer there. But this is the second book I've written kind of as an independent scholar. So I'm out there writing these books because I want to use political science and history and political theory to inform our current, you know, debates and discussions. And that's how I – so I teach a class at the University of Virginia called Leadership, Statesmanship, and Democracy. I taught it before this book was finished, so it was kind of a way to work out some of the ideas. I taught it after it was finished this last fall. And to me, where the book – you know, it was reviewed in the Wall Street Journal. It's been I've been on a lot of media since then. I was recently – you know, I've been on NPR's Morning Edition and here, which is wonderful. And to me, the discussion of the book is how do we fight for statesmanship as a political practice in our current democracy. I'm very concerned that we have forgotten entirely about this, not just as something that's built into the way that the founding fathers talked about federal judges or the U.S. Senate. They did talk in very explicit terms about people doing the stuff that Madison did, challenging the public, educating the public, calming the passions, thinking about how we're designing the state, becoming experts on subjects themselves, trying to grow the democracy in a constitutional direction through positive steps. That's what he did. That's what statesmen do. I am very concerned at this moment in our democracy that we've kind of completely forgotten about that part of the system. I think we ought to have, you know, like with this Donald Trump phenomenon, which is one of the reasons that I've been in the media a lot recently with both books, I really think that there ought to be around the country people who see their role as fighting for this part of the Constitution and the constitutional democracy. There is part of this democracy which is passions rushing around and demagogues rising to play to the passions. You're not going to get rid of that, but there needs to be a part of a healthy constitutional democracy where there are people saying, let's calm down here. Let's think about our higher purposes. Let's not just thrash around in this festival of the appetites, which is what I called it in this other recent interview. I wrote a piece for The Atlantic where I talked about how Donald Trump was playing to the passions, and then a piece for The Washington Post where I concluded that he was at last a demagogue because he had crossed some of these lines. So the book to me is I wanted to be a clarion call to think about this man and to understand him better and to have a relationship with him in the same way that we have a relationship with these other huge figures in our national consciousness like Jefferson or like Adams. Or I think it's time for Madison to have his moment. There was a review of this book along with several others by Richard Brookhiser, who's a well-known scholar, which said, as in the Daily Beast, it said Madison, the Madison moment or Madison mania, I think. And I think that's really healthy for the country. You know, we tend to look for heroism, and I think that it's time that we look for something else.
Do you not think that he has any modern-day sort of counterparts? Surely there are some statesmen in Washington, some people that we know.
I think that what Tim Kaine, one of our senators, has done on the War Powers Act, on saying that the administration needs to have a legal rationale for its hostilities against ISIS and the related terrorist organizations in the Middle East, and not just rely on the 2001 vote to authorize force against Iraq, is extremely statesmanlike. Very complicated, difficult issue to deal with, because who in Congress wants to go back and pass another resolution of war? But Kaine, who I've known for a long time and have admired for a long time, he really has seen an issue here where he thinks it's good for the country, it's good for the common good to get our act together on that. And it's required him to challenge and lead public opinion, to go out and hold debates, to buttonhole other people, to write pieces. And it shows somebody actually being kind of intellectual force on a difficult issue and leading the public. I also praised Rand Paul, of all people, for what he had done with about drones on the floor of the Senate. I think that the filibuster he did on drones, you know, people could tap him for being self-promoting or sensational, but most politicians are guilty of that in one way or another. What I thought was interesting about what he did with the filibuster on drones was I thought that it was morally serious. I thought that he was trying to change the debate. I thought he was trying to improve the debate based on his knowledge. With the Donald Trump phenomenon, you know, there have been a number of people who have started stepping out and talking about how this demagogue is endangering or putting at risk our deeper constitutional traditions or our civic Republican values. He's not a politician, but Tom Brokaw did a nightly news piece where he really squarely confronted the idea to ban Muslims from coming into the country, which is just noxious and anti almost everything that we stand for. And he did it by calling our attention back to our purposes as an inclusive, pluralistic society where Muslim Americans have fought for the country, and he went to the gravesite of somebody at Arlington National Cemetery who was a Muslim. And, you know, I think that there are statesmanlike acts a lot, but they lack a kind of coherence and they lack an intellectual kind of an umbrella, whereas they did a long time ago. One of the books I teach in my class is a wonderful book by Ira Shapiro with my publisher, Public Affairs, called The Last Great Senate. It was about the Senate from 1976 to 1980. You had leaders like Frank Church, who had led a really robust Senate effort to look at intelligence practices in the country. You had Robert Byrd. You had Ted Kennedy. You had Scoop Jackson. You had these are very serious leaders who referred to and thought of themselves as statesmen, and they were using the Senate in that way to advance debate, to work collegially among one another, to challenge, to govern the passions, to help the country toward the future, to educate the public. And that is wonderful. You know, you can have people disagree and fight like cats and dogs on the Senate floor with parliamentary procedure. And then they knew each other afterward because they had all agreed that the country needed statesmen, even if the statesmen would disagree frequently. It was a healthy part of the country.
Yeah, exactly. And will you in any way be inspired by Madison as you pursue your own political career?
I am every day. I was just recently selected as the new mayor of Charlottesville 2 weeks ago today, which is a town of almost 50,000 people. It's AAA bond rated. I'll say my other mayoral things. I'm very proud of that. I'm very excited for it. In my first remarks in our first city council meeting, I said I wasn't going to try and achieve symbolic victories alone. I said I wasn't going to play to people's passions. I said I saw a real need for rebutting the cynicism that we hear about all the time, that they kind of, you know, it's a brush that people tar almost every institute in our public life with, including local government. There's a lot of cynicism about government, and I want to rebut that cynicism by using the city council to model governance. That can be as simple as Robert's Rules of Order and following the rules of respect to one another. I talked a lot about respect for among our city council and from our city council to staff. I sit in these meetings and I look around at the people working so hard on issues like expanding pre-K or getting a bridge finished or dealing with this hulk of an abandoned hotel we have on the downtown mall called the Landmark Hotel, which has blighted, you know, the central part of Charlottesville. These are complicated issues, but we can get them solved, and it requires faith in governance. And so I'm really excited for that challenge, and I'm going to do my part everywhere I go to try and follow. I mean, I'm no Madison, but I'm going to try and follow this method, which is figuring out where I stand, what is my conviction, what is my conscience, knowing what I'm talking about, engaging in a debate with the public, trying to help inform the public, trying to deal with opponents respectfully but strongly, you know, and above all, not just whipsawing around with the passions. It still is, you know, it's important now as it ever was. And I really want to figure out what the answers are for the common good. That's always what guided Madison. And, you know, at my much smaller, more humble level, I do think that I took a lot from writing this book that I'm going to try to apply.
You're young. How old are you?
43. I don't feel that young.
All right. Well, there's time yet, though. This is the start.
I do have twin almost 16-month-old boys who keep me I'm not technically young, but they force me to behave as if I'm young. Otherwise, I would fail them. So I was just rolling around the floor with them this morning.
Well, and you'll find over the years that you're hanging out with the parents of their friends,
which
will also keep you
young.
They'll
keep me young.
Well, very well said. Thank you so much. And
good
luck in all of your endeavors. Is there another book in the works, or are you just going to be busy being mayor?
There is, I hope. I have moved around on it a little bit. And just because I'm flush off of the brainstorm from the last couple days, I am interested in possibly writing about wisdom in democracies. I feel like we don't think about or look for wisdom from our elders or from ourselves very much. And I think it'd be such an interesting book, but I'm not going to be able to do that for a couple of years.
You're a realist. Well, we'll look for that when it comes. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.